DW.
Well, if we're going to talk about Raqqa, I think it's a bit of both. Physically, they may have left the city, but their legacy remains in the form of IEDs that littered the whole city. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of devices in different shapes and sizes that are hidden in buildings and streets. You still have a fair amount of dead bodies that lay under the concrete and steel rubble. And some of them have been also booby-trapped, the bodies. Other forms of IEDs have been, for example, money lying on the floor of residential blocks, children toys, plastic bottles, rubbish. So it's a long and arduous process clearing the IEDs that has been undertaken by INGOs in Raqqa.
Talking of the legacy that IS left behind in Raqqa, all those improvised explosive devices, the booby traps, what do people in this former stronghold, this IS stronghold, have to say about IS?
They're glad that they don't have to witness the executions, and it's a bit of a... I did ask this question, and you don't get a straightforward answer, because you don't know if this will bring a next wave of armed groups or armed forces in the city, which will just bring again another round of chaos and confusion within the city. And I think when you've had the regime, al-Nusra, the Free Syrian Army, and then IS, I think you just, in most cases, the feeling that I got from people is that they're really trying to see a future for themselves within the city.
So it's also, I suppose, that they're trying to also to be very diplomatic, because things can change so fast, or that's the experience they've made. One day it's this group, the next day it's another group, so you have to be careful, I suppose, who you criticise or who you talk badly about.
I mean, I think that's an extremely valid point as well, is that there was this aspect of fear in the air, of paranoia, that who you could talk to, who could you trust, and who would report you for a minor offence or for a major offence. So it's also, as you say, that people are still in their shells to some extent and keeping themselves to themselves. They're more comfortable talking to a foreigner rather than a local. Bear in mind that IS was there for 3.5 years, and if someone has been in your backyard for the last 3.5 years, you don't change from one day to another into being a normal, functional human being, I guess.
Talking about the reconstruction process and, you know, moving on from this period of fear, Raqqa and other towns completely destroyed, how are they going about rebuilding these towns?
You see vehicles bringing in concrete bags, people constructing, making their own bricks, people repairing their own walls, repairing shops. This is a very slow process. But life is returning, but at a very slow pace. Those who have returned, because, I mean, at the moment, for civilians who have returned, there's no running water or electricity at the moment in the city. So the only thing that is keeping them warm are these diesel stoves, which are very common, actually, in the area. Those are the challenges faced by a typical normal family. If this family has children or many children, then obviously coming back to the issue we mentioned early on is IEDs, telling or instructing children just to walk only on treaded paths, not to wander into buildings, not to play around in rubble, as IEDs have killed many, many civilians and continue to do so.
We're also hearing some sounds right now that of people getting water, and perhaps you could elaborate a bit on what we're hearing right now.
I mean, what we're hearing now is the wife and mother of the family pouring water from a bucket into a water barrel for the whole family. There is this issue of no running water in the city, and a water truck delivers water to residential areas once a day. So when it comes to water and hygiene, families do the best they can in terms of, you know, keeping their children clean. And of course, another thing is, you know, preparing food and coffee. Everything, every drop is counted. That's something that I noticed.
Phil, as you just explained, life is returning to some of the destroyed cities such as Raqqa, and they're trying to recreate the lives that they once had to a certain degree, just with the basics as well. Fresh water, for instance, very important. How do these people that stayed behind and lived through the entire war in Syria, the ones you talk to, how did they feel about the Syrians who fled the country, who went to Europe as refugees and avoided all this, well, at least avoided the war? How did they feel about them?
If you were to talk to 10 different people, you'd probably get 10 different answers. Different people, depending on their background, if be it social, be it religious, were in different situations, which led one family or another, or relatives or another, to flee Syria. There are also very painful decisions by families. In instances, if there were two brothers or two sisters, which brother should leave, which one should stay behind, which one would handle the situation better, say, under IS authorities. In one of the IED camps, I spoke to Kaswa, a mother of 10 children. She comes from Deizor, which is a currently regime-controlled city, but in the nearby area, IS is still very much active. And this is what she had to say.
Firstly, I have two sons in Germany. I can't let them return to Syria because the regime would take them into the army. Secondly, I ask people to empathize with us, to feel what we feel here on the ground, in the country. I'm so tired, and not just me. Many people here are tired. They simply want to return to their villages. For people here, from the villages, the most important thing is their land, where they were born. And in order for us to return, the war must end. We simply want to return to our homes.
In Wells in Raqqa, I also spoke to a man who lost his clothing business. And he also has friends in Germany that he's in touch on a regular basis. And he said that he would like to see Syrians return back to Syria, Syrians who made it to Europe or to European Union, and to rebuild the country. And it's not a question of rebuilding as in bricks and mortar and water, but the professional class. He talks of the brain drain currently affecting the country. And he basically said at the end of the conversation that he wonders if his friends and colleagues will ever return. Those with money fled to Europe, and the poor have stayed behind.
So he feels the responsibility to also rebuild his own country again.
That's right.
Phil, not all people can or want to return to their hometowns. For instance, a lot of the people in the IDP camps, they have nowhere to go. You also went to such camps. How did the people there respond to the current situation? What did they tell you about how they think life's going to go on for them?
One gentleman that I spoke to, his name is Hussein Suleiman. He comes from the Deir ez-Zor region and has a wife and two children. And he was a regime policeman before the war. Since there is no schooling or education in the camp, he's afraid that this will affect his son.
When we had airstrikes over our villages, I tried to do everything to protect my children. They are the most important thing to me. They are my life. And now, here in the camp, I very much worry about my boy. He's 7 years old. He should be going to school, but there's no school here. In a few years' time, he might forget how to read or write. It's such a dangerous thing if children don't have access to school.
Like in many IDP camps that I've been to, a quite common scene is children running around. But talking to their parents, one thing that is certainly on their mind, which they're very much concerned about, is will these children end up knowing and understanding their own language? And how will this affect the future generation of Syrian children, no matter the region? Many of them come from the southeastern region, others come from the western region. And it's getting the educational system back on its feet. That is a cause for concern.
Speaking on a personal level now, and not so much as a journalist, what is it that you took back for yourself from this Syria trip? What would you say has affected you the most or has maybe changed your outlook the most?
It's a very poignant question for me. At one of the IDP camps, where I spoke to many families who had fled from Raqqa, I would say that this was probably one of the most upsetting and disturbing moments during the trip, talking actually to these children who'd come up and out of the blue started to talk about of their experiences, what they had seen, what they saw, what they remembered in terms of, say, executions conducted by IS. And there's no doubt that they've been affected and traumatized by those events. And if they are not given, say, psychological or mental assistance, or it would be difficult to say what kind of childhood or what kind of person they'll grow up to be. On a lighter note, talking to the family who had returned to Raqqa, who live on the fourth floor without any running water or electricity, when you see how little they have and how they make you, and yet how they make you feel at home, one may talk of hospitality in its various forms. And the last thing I expected was to be served coffee, and actually it was very good coffee. And what I would like to say is that to put into words the welcome, the friendliness, the warmth and the kindness showed by this family, like many other families that I came across and met in the country, one could certainly take a leaf out of their book, and something that I'll pretty much will remember.
Phil, thank you very much for joining us on Worldling and sharing your experience from that recent reporting trip to Syria with us.
Thank you very much.
This report was brought to you by DW.